Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, Hut listeners. This is Broth of the Hut. Welcome back once more to another episode of Broth's News Balancing Act podcast. As always, I'm your host, Broth of the Hut, with my co-host, Sandy the Girl Cat, who is currently taking a nap right now. It always feels good to be back speaking in front of a microphone for all of you listeners out there. Today, I don't know why, but I have a glass of scotch with me, just because I want to. The day that I'm recording it is July 5th, 2020, so a day after the 4th of July, Independence Day. For those of you that celebrated with fireworks and stuff, I kind of celebrated with you as well, just sitting in my house. Well, actually, last night I was hanging out with some folks. With social distancing intact, and saw a bunch of fireworks going on, so I thought that was pretty fun. I will not touch on any race-specific topics today, so I will refuse to talk about in detail the sense of inequality when it comes to looking at Independence Day in its truest forms in America. I know I'm being very vague here, but I'm sure some of you already realize that back in 1776, July 4th, when the Declaration of Independence was written and signed, declaring the United States formally seceding from Britain, that of course it sparked off the Revolutionary War between Britain and the United States, of which the United States desired independence. And of course, there are certain peoples that lived at that time during the Revolutionary War who were not free, who fought in the Revolutionary War, slaves and fellow African Americans who fought for the country's independence, but they themselves were not given any independence after the fact. So, we have to look at history with multiple lenses, and as we celebrate the veterans, those in the military who have chosen to potentially give up their lives for defending America's ideals, their lives should be recognized and remembered and respected. And at the same time, you have to recognize there are a bunch of boneheads who make irrational decisions to war and to battles and to challenges, which put these people's lives at risk, all in the name of independence. Anyway, before I start rambling onwards, the topic for this week, there she is. Sandy the Girl Cat has entered the chat. Entered the podcast. Hey, Sandy. How you doing? I think she's more interested in the window today. So I'll just leave her alone. Our topic this week is the Supreme Court. Of course, there have been a lot of headlines within the past few weeks, within the last month or so, of all of these Supreme Court decisions or indecisions surrounding anything from voting rights to LGBT rights to abortion rights. So, I will only pick a few articles this week. The first two articles I have mainly talking about voting rights, because that seems to be the most recent thing, and an article just about church and state and stuff. Blah, 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 blah. Anyway, let's go to the first article here. Ooh, by the way, the scotch of choice that I have for today is a Lafroy Lore, L-O-R-E. Probably one of the most aromatic and flavorful scotches I've ever had. So definitely, if you could find yourself a bottle, go and try it at your own leisure, as long as you're 21 or over, and would be willing to try scotch straight. Anyway, this first article is from Vox, and of course, I'm sure quite a few of you know that Vox is a left-leaning news media article or website, however you want to identify them. And this article comes to you from a writer or a journalist named Ian Millhiser, written a couple days ago, July 3rd, 2020. The Supreme Court just handed down some truly awful news for voting rights. Voting rights during the pandemic are in deep trouble thanks to this Supreme Court. Well, based on some charged words there, I would assume that it is an opinion article, but it definitely is not. So, in terms of trying to balance out the news, you can already tell that the journalist is already trying to push some agendas here. So, let me just quickly peruse through. The Supreme Court handed down two brief unsigned orders on Friday concerning what restrictions states may place on absentee voting during the coronavirus pandemic. Though neither order is a final judgment, one grants a temporary stay of a lower court decision. The other denies expedited review of an important voting rights case. The practical impact of both orders is that voters in Alabama and Texas will find it harder to cast a ballot during the pandemic. The Texas order is particularly ominous because it suggests that Texas will be able to apply election rules that ensure that older, Republican-leaning voters have an easy time casting a ballot, while younger voters could be forced to risk infection in order to vote. So let's look at the Alabama case first that Vox shows us. The Alabama case is Merrill versus People First of Alabama. Alabama law allows anyone to cast an absentee ballot during the pandemic, but it also imposes certain restrictions on those voters. Among other things, absentee voters must provide a copy of their photo ID, and their ballot must be signed by either two witnesses or one notary public. A lower court blocked these restrictions. Quote, "For voters who cannot safely obtain the signatures of two witnesses or notary public due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and for absentee voters who are over the age of 65 or disabled who cannot safely obtain a copy of their photo ID due to the pandemic," end quote. But the Supreme Court stayed that lower court decision, ensuring that at the very least, the restrictions will be in place for Alabama's July 14th runoff primary election. Notably, the Supreme Court's order in Merrill was joined only by the court's five Republicans. All four Democratic appointees dissented. Neither side explained why they voted the way that they did. My opinion, or my analysis already coming in, is that personally for me, I don't like the way that all of the journalists and news media, left and right, have more or less put the judges into the two-party system ideas. So of course, you know, five of the Supreme Court justices are or have been appointed by a Republican president, and four of the justices are appointed by a Democratic president. Courts should be, quote unquote, politically neutral. Of course, you could go into that. And to force political nuances, terms, definitions on them, kind of. Even though most of their decisions does lean towards one political side versus another, I really hate them being termed that way. Anyway, back to the article. Texas case. The Texas case, meanwhile, is named Texas Democratic Party versus Abbott, and the stakes in that case are simply enormous. Texas law permits voters over the age of 65 to request absentee ballots without difficulty, but most voters under the age of 65 are not allowed to vote absentee. During a pandemic election, that means that older voters, a demographic that was historically favored Republican, that has during a pandemic election, that means that older voters, a Democratic that demographic that has historically favored Republicans over Democrats, will have a fairly easy time participating in the November election. But younger voters will likely have to risk infection at an in-person polling site if they wish to cast a ballot. This arrangement is difficult to square with the 26th Amendment, which provides that the right of citizens of the United States who are 18 years of age or older to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of age. I did not know the 26th Amendment said that. The court's order in Texas Democratic Party is subtle, but it most likely means that Texas will be able to deny or abridge the right to vote on account of age, at least during the November election. Last month, the conservative United States Courts of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit blocked a trial judge's order that would have allowed younger Texans to vote absentee. Although this Fifth Circuit order is not the appeals court, the appeals court's last words on this case, it is quite unlikely that the plaintiffs in the Texas Democratic Party will prevail before the Fifth Circuit, which is among the most conservative courts in the country. So those plaintiffs asked the Supreme Court to hear their case on an expedited basis. On Friday, the Supreme Court denied that request. As a practical matter, writes SCOTUS Blog's Amy Ho, this refusal to expedite the Texas Democratic Party case all but eliminated the prospect that the justices will weigh in on the merits of that dispute before the 2020 election in November. Back to me and my thoughts. I'm wondering what the cases on deck are for the Supreme Court, and exactly how this expedited process application is for. I could imagine where there are cases concerning death penalty. I could see that probably having a lot of applications for an expedited case. I can understand why this specific court case was being pushed for an expedited hearing. But, again, so, let me go back to the article before I say anything else. Thus, if the Supreme Court ultimately does decide that Texas's age discrimination violates the 26th Amendment, that decision will most certainly come up too late to benefit anyone in November. Let's see here. The Supreme Court's orders in the Merrill and Texas Democratic Party cases fit a pattern. Last April, in the Republican National Committee versus Democratic National Committee, I didn't even know there was a court case that they had, the Supreme Court granted a request from the Republican Party and ordered all ballots mailed after a certain date in Wisconsin's April elections to be tossed out, a decision that in practice likely forced thousands of voters to risk infection in order to cast an in-person ballot. The court's decision in the RNC versus DNC was also 5-4, with all five Republican justices in a majority and all four in dissent. In recent weeks, the court has handed down a handful of left-leaning decisions, including a narrow decision temporarily preserving DACA, and even a narrower decision striking down a Louisiana anti-abortion law. Now, personally, I thought the narrow decision for both was 5-4. So, let me just click on that, because I personally think that might be a wrong way for them to write. Yeah, the Supreme Court saved DACA, and it's a 5-4 decision. So, I'm just nitpicking here, but let me read this sentence again. In recent weeks, the court has handed down a handful of left-leaning decisions, including a narrow decision temporarily preserving DACA, and even a narrower decision striking down a Louisiana anti-abortion law. Both had a court decision of 5-4. How can one be narrower than the other when both of them had a decision of 5-4? Grammatically, it doesn't work. Grammatically, it's just wrong. Anyway, we're not the Baratha News Grammar Podcast. It's the News Balancing Act. So, Vox, get your stuff together here. Back to the last paragraph. But on the most important question of democracy, whether citizens are empowered to choose their own leaders, the Supreme Court remains unsympathetic to parties seeking to protect the right to vote despite the greatest public health crisis of more than a century. Okay. All right. Now, analyzing this article, definitely the last paragraph here is super charged, super left-leaning. Balanced? No. Not at all. There's a lot of, for lack of a better term, a lot of a democratic feel to this article. Ugh. I'm actually really glad that they gave information of the Merrill versus People First of Alabama, as well as the Texas Democratic Party versus Abbott. I really do appreciate that they gave descriptions on these two specific cases, mainly because it does pertain to voting rights in the United States. So it seems like to me, as I'm calming down now, is that at least for now, there has not been a final court decision and opinion in closing these cases. In the Alabama case, at the very least for the July 14th runoff election, whatever lower court decision was made, to work on COVID, that's there. And of course, in Texas, the case more or less, you have to wait until next year for the Supreme Court to hear the case and to decide on it. Which, of course, I understand the journalist saying that because we have to wait, or because the Supreme Court denied an expedited hearing, that it seems all likely that they'll have to look at in 2021. I think it's very obvious that in the Texas case, the 26th Amendment is being violated. Am I upset that the Supreme Court is not hearing it before the November election? Yes, I'm pretty upset. I would like to know the full picture before the journalist, more or less to me, it seems like the journalist is already condemning the Supreme Court in this case. I would not want to condemn the Supreme Court. Why? Because as a citizen of the United States, you have to be, it is your responsibility to understand the democratic process and the democratic system that we are using. That includes trying to understand how the Supreme Court works, not just by saying, can we add more justices in the seat and can we fill the bench? Or why are there Republican, judges and Democratic judges? Why didn't the Senate appoint President Obama's choice of Merrick Garland? And that's the stuff in which seems to be the pervasive talk when it comes to the Supreme Court, and not enough discussion of how does the Supreme Court actually work. I've never heard of this expedited process before. I don't even know how many cases get brought up to the Supreme Court. I don't even know how many they accept or how many they deny. I don't know how many they listen to in a year. I don't know how long it takes for them to actually, quote unquote, vote or choose the decision. I don't know any of this. And I'm supposed to listen to this Vox journalist more or less inferring condemnation on the Supreme Court. And yes, voting rights is very important. Absolutely. Again, it's the right of every citizen of the United States to participate in the voting process because it is part of the democratic process in which we live in. So, pay attention to the voting rights and how more or less that is being circumvented in some way or another. Also pay attention to this, to how the Supreme Court works. Rather than just saying the Supreme Court's wrong, Supreme Court's wrong. Supreme Court's doing a bad job. Well, I don't even know what their real job is. Or not, I know what their job is, to choose cases and to decide on them on the basis of the Constitution. How do they do it? I do not know. And I doubt that the average American does not know either, because our education system does not really teach that to a full degree. They talk about the three branches of government and goes into basic descriptions on what each branch of government does. But where are the details? Where are the details? Okay, onwards to the next article from jurist.org, Legal News and Research, a collaboration with the University of Pittsburgh. I actually have not heard of this site before, but they also talked a little bit about the Supreme Court's decisions on these voting rights. Much shorter article. And I think I'll just read it to all of you. Jurist.org. Supreme Court grants request to reimpose voting restrictions written yesterday, July 4th, 2020. By Zoe Gujral. The Supreme Court granted Alabama's request to reinstate photo ID and witness requirements for absentee ballots on Thursday. As is typical of such briefs, the court did not explain their 5-4 decision. The decision overturns an order issued by U.S. District Judge Abdul Kalin that made it easier for people in 3 Alabama counties to vote. When Alabama's Secretary of State John Merrill expand absentee voting due to the pandemic, he did not ease the restrictions placed on absentee ballots. Currently, Alabama voters must submit absentee ballots with a copy of their photo ID and affidavit signed by a notary public or to adult witnesses. Voters' rights groups argue that this places an unlawful burden on voters and that the compliance puts voters' lives and health at risk. Merrill has dismissed these concerns. People First of Alabama and other voting rights organizations sued the state of Alabama over the restrictions. Judge Kalin ruled in their favor, and Alabama filed a timely appeal. It also asked the 11th Circuit to stay the order while their appeal moved forward. The 11th Circuit denied the request, and Alabama appealed the denial to the court. The state has argued that Judge Kalin issued his decision too close to the election. Lawyers for the voting rights groups dispute this and insist that Alabama has not provided sufficient reasons for maintaining the voting restrictions during a pandemic. The court's decision is in line with recent decisions upholding restrictions on voting despite the risks inherent during a pandemic. Last month, the court rejected a request that would have allowed everyone in Texas to vote by mail. In April, the court overturned a Wisconsin district court's judge's ruling that extended the absentee ballot deadline. The Wisconsin decision came down close to the election, which the governor had attempted to push back over public safety concerns. The Wisconsin Supreme Court overruled the governor's attempt. So this is specifically the case in Alabama. Again, so let me read the first line again. The Supreme Court granted Alabama's request to reinstate photo ID and witness requirements for absentee ballots. As is typical of such briefs, the court did not explain the 5-4 decision. So, this article tried to trace back why this case came up in the first place. So, Alabama had certain laws surrounding absentee voting, voting by mail, which had to have more or less, you need to prove that you are the person filling out this ballot and sending it by mail. So you have to have your photo ID and an affidavit signed by a notary public or 2 adult witnesses. Without going into the attempting to find the logic behind that law in Alabama, it does make sense that people are trying to stop that law from happening, specifically in COVID-19. Because if I was a regular person and someone asked me to be a witness, I wouldn't want to stand close to you because I would have to take that piece of paper and sign it. Same with a notary. I would not want to put a notary in potential danger if I was a carrier of COVID. And vice versa, you don't want the person voting absentee to potentially get it from the witnesses or the notary. And assuming that the majority of absentee voters are older citizens, that they'd be in the at-risk category, which means that they would not benefit from this law. Very, very interesting. Again, the Supreme Court rules based on the Constitution and the amendments. And the way to do that, you have two, more or less nowadays, you have two ideas where you look at the actual words on the law and you are very literal with the law that was written itself, or you can base generalizations out of it. I could definitely tell you that the laws weren't written with COVID in mind. So yeah, there should be some bending or some updated laws written. Oh no! Don't turn off computer. Please don't turn off. My computer's going to sleep. I'm trying to turn it back on. There we go. Whew. That was a close to disaster moment right there. I like this article a lot better, a lot more straightforward. I wish it did flesh out more details concerning the Alabama case and maybe a little bit more background information. But otherwise, personally, in my opinion, I like this article a lot more than the Vox article. Again, you don't hear the when you compare it to Vox, there is no condemnation felt against the Supreme Court. There are no supercharged words there. So, yeah. Anyway, on to the third article here. LA Times. Dun, dun, dun. And this one says opinion, so it definitely is an opinion article. Letters to the editor. The Supreme Court further erodes the wall between church and state. Oh wow, so not just one, so three letters to the editor concerning the Supreme Court, church and state. I'm assuming these articles talk about, or sorry, can't speak. These letters that I'm going to read to you, there are three letters here that talk about separation of church and state. I'm assuming it's based on a recent decision by the Supreme Court that more or less says that private schools, specifically private religious schools, are allowed to take state funding. And that's mainly out of state. Quite a few states have laws where you can use a voucher to help pay for tuition at these private schools. So let me read these three letters to you. So to the editor, from someone named Jane Roberts in the Redlands, and I'm saying their names because it's in the LA Times and it's public. And if you write to the editor, there is an understanding that it's public. So, Miss Jane Roberts from the Redlands. To the editor, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, has said that states may not exclude private religious schools if they give tuition grants that support other non-sectarial private schools. Oh, there we go. I am an atheist. I would not be completely opposed to some tuition and aid going to secular private schools, although I am an ardent supporter of public education. But the minute any of my tax money goes to sectarian schools, I would be angry. Any and all religion should be kept in private domain. Science, reason, common sense, and observation make clear to me the correctness of my position. Second one. John T. Kyrgios from Arcadia. Arcadia is in the Arcadians from Canada. Arcadia is in Arcadia University near Philadelphia. I don't know where Arcadia is. I also like the Redlands too, because that sounds pretty awesome. To the editor from John. Your articles refer to religious schools. There's a difference between the terms religious schools and schools operated by the religious organizations. Tell me more. Religious schools teach students to become ministers or priests. Oh, all right. Schools operated by religious organizations primarily teach as any secular school does, except they include instruction in religion. My two sons attended such a high school, and they did not become priests because of that instruction. They received a well-rounded education consisting of all subjects that are taught in secular schools, but also received some instruction on basic religion philosophy. Both were accepted into a well-regarded university. It is important when referring to such schools that the correct terminology is used also is used so any bias against religion can be eliminated. All right. And third letter from Marsha Goldstein from Laguna Woods. Laguna Woods? Laguna Beach? I don't know. Probably somewhere in Florida or California or somewhere where there's a lagoon. To the editor. Under the Supreme Court, our constitutional right of freedom of religion can be compared to a man sitting in the chair of a bad barber. It is getting chopped at and not looking very good. With no sense of irony, the court ruled that a state forbidding itself from subsidizing religious education but not secular private education amounts to discrimination. Overlooked is the fact that a taxpayer should never be required to finance religious indoctrination of any sort. The court is putting its thumb on religious scales. Whoa, that's a weird sentence. Okay, let me repeat it. The court putting its thumb on religious scales was evidence in its recent decisions having to do with the cake maker and the Hobby Lobby store chain, in which the justices interpreted freedom of religion to mean the freedom to impose one's religious beliefs on others. Businesses were allowed to deny services to people who did not follow the tenets of their owners' religions regarding homosexuality and birth control. A gay couple could be denied a wedding cake, and employees could be denied contraception. These are disturbing decisions. All right, interesting short letters to everyone, to the editor. Not what I expected. I thought it was going to be a little bit more of a, whatchamacallit, in-depth critiques of the Supreme Court and how they've recently decided on religious affiliated cases. If I were to critique further against these folks... or let's see why the LA Times chose these three. So the first letter to the editor from Jane does not like the ruling. They would not want state funds or tuition aid going to religious private schools. Second letter from John. Doesn't express his frustration, tries to hide his bias, I think, in a way, in this letter. And he wants to distinguish between, again, religious schools versus schools operated by the religious organizations. And he tries to distinguish the two. Religious schools teach students to become ministers or priests. Not necessarily true. I mean, you're using the definition that way. You would call... there is a term. There is a specific term for schools that teach people to become ministers and priests. And that is a seminary. Right? Or you're trying to get a master's in divination. So things like that. And I would like to disagree with you, sir, because you're just making you are narrowing the definition of the word religious schools, for your own benefit in writing this article. When you're saying religious schools, in your definition, it's a seminary. Just say seminary. While you can say religious schools based on whatever critique you had. Schools operated by religious organizations, that's a religious school. That's a religious school. That is a religious school, even if they're not trying to make your son a priest. Villanova University, it's a private school. It's a private college. It's a private university. It is operated by a religious order within the Catholic Church. So it's operated by a religious organization. They are a private religious school. They don't specifically teach people to become priests or nuns. And they are not a seminary. You have people who are in a seminary, in a school specifically, catered to teaching you how to be a priest or a minister. And those people who attend the seminary sometimes go to Villanova University to take some classes on religion. So I disagree with you there, John. Anyway, third letter by Marcia under the Supreme Court, our constitutional right of freedom. Very similar to the first letter where Marcia disagrees with the choices, the decisions that the Supreme Court made recently on religious affiliated cases. And I do remember, so, you know what? Folks, let's go straight to court of opinion because it's going to definitely drift into there now. All right, folks, how are you doing so far? So, what was I gonna say? Yes, the reason why I wanted to transition now to court of opinion was that I remember reading or listening to one of the justices saying that it's becoming increasingly difficult to interpret the First Amendment over and over again when it comes to religion. And I found it very enlightening in a way because, you know, when you think about it seriously, the separation of church and state, trying to keep it separate, but at the same time, the government has to make sure that religion can't be infringed upon. So it's kind of like a dichotomy in a way, or you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. I'm trying to think of other ways to describe it. You're trying to the government, the United States of America, has to defend the rights of religion for anyone, in terms of practice, right? That's what the First Amendment says. The First Amendment also says that there has to be a separation where religion can't be a driving force in decisions of the government. So in a sense, just like, oh, you can't. It's very difficult as human beings because there are some people who subscribe to a certain religion, a certain spirituality, that it shapes a lot of their decisions. You also have to look at the fact that you have to defend one religion from another if one particular religion starts attacking and discriminating against another religion. So the question here becomes, well, how do you interpret it when it becomes a little bit more muddied when it comes to the private sector? And then you expand it into, well, not just private sector, the public sector. When you look at the Affordable Care Act, ACA, Obamacare, and see how the understanding of birth control is used. And of course, there are certain religions that go against birth control. There are certain religions that go against abortion. And you have, based on how the US works now, more or less it comes to the Supreme Court now to figure out how the hell do we navigate this. And you have Justice John Roberts, who has openly said that he does not like to make precedents, aka he doesn't like to make a new, potentially controversial ruling that would change the landscape of future decisions. One of the things that I definitely know about the Supreme Court is that they look at previous cases and they try to look at that as guidance to decide on the future of the cases that they will look at. So I was just like, wow, it's in a way it's limiting. And in other ways, it's kind of just weird because we understand the intentions of America's forefathers who wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. We understand their intention. As I mentioned earlier in the podcast, the interpretations of the Constitution have more or less grown into two different groups. One who is very literal, textualizing by the words and how people intended at that time that it was written. And you have people who look at the Constitution as a living document, able to be logically looked at, or to be looked at logically in new perspectives. So you have two, more or less these two factions working in the Supreme Court right now. And of course, if you're looking at history for what it is, they never expected something like COVID-19. They never understood sexuality and gender as it is now. And of course, more or less, let me just say it, even back then, when the Constitution was written, when the Bill of Rights was written, that there are a lot of religious ideas put into the Constitution, which personally I don't like. A lot of things wrong with religion. And we're talking about a guy who's Catholic and Buddhist. And you have a Constitution that it wasn't until the 1800s that an amendment was written to free slaves from slavery. Right, so I think what I'm trying to say is, fundamentally, we all know that the Supreme Court has to interpret the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and all of the amendments to the Constitution. They select a number of cases each year. How many, I don't know. How many gets put in front of their faces, I don't know. But they base their decisions out of interpretation, based on simple majority, on how they interpret the Constitution. Wouldn't it be more straightforward to take advantage of the voting process and work very hard to vote in, say, progressives into Congress, to vote in people that align with you in the legislative branch and the executive branch, and then work on adding amendments to the Constitution to explicitly state more equality for people? Wouldn't that be more straightforward rather than voting for a president and then praying or hoping that they would choose a future justice that would, quote-unquote, be on their side, be on the Democratic or the Republican side? Because, unfortunately, that's what's happening in the media right now is, oh, look, we thought this was going to be the most conservative Supreme Court in decades, and it will be for decades, and they're just going to vote away all of our rights, or they're going to decide away all of our rights. Well, we've seen that the Supreme Court in this session has been against the grain, against the media's grain, in a bunch of these cases. And of course, voting rights, and in a sense, separation of church and state, looks like it's leaning, quote-unquote, towards the right. Again, quote-unquote. And then with LGBT, that recent decision from Louisiana, or the recent, sorry, the anti-abortion case, that was leaning, quote-unquote, towards left. And that has rocked the giant news medias so far because it has gone against their, quote-unquote, understanding of how the Supreme Court is run. Again, how does the Supreme Court operate? I don't know. I know what they have to do. I'm sure you know what they have to do. And I've been saying, I'm saying this 2-3 times already, and I'll keep on saying it. They can only interpret the Constitution and cases from before. But of course, we've seen that they've looked at cases before, and they've regretted some cases, like the Dred Scott decision and Plessy versus Ferguson and stuff like that. The Supreme Court interprets the Constitution and its amendments. Worked very hard to vote for progressive candidates into the legislative body, the federal legislative body, as well as the federal executive branch, and then work on creating amendments. And at the same time, work on the states. State that you live in, need to make sure that your state constitution also grants more rights to people. Because, as we have seen throughout history, even recent history with all the protests, because equal rights has not been written explicitly anywhere, you will inevitably lose it. That's all it is. Well, I'm not saying it's all it is, but the most straightforward thing we can do, the most straightforward thing that I can think of right now. Right. That's why a group like the Democratic Socialists of America is becoming more and more known each day. Not more powerful, because I don't want to bring a power dynamic to it, but they're being more well known and they're gaining traction with a lot of younger people because they are talking about things like fundamentally changing the process. Right. Just a side note, I'm not in the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America. And I actively choose not to be a member of them. And that's only because of my own personal, or I would say the history that I have, that my family has, that Cambodia has with socialism. I just don't want to be associated with the term socialist. And of course, West versus East, there are different meanings behind that. And I am opening up and I am welcome to listening to those differences. As of right now, I do not want to associate myself with the word socialism because of the way that genocide has occurred in Southeast Asia. If you talk about how those white Americans that don't want to be associated with socialism, it's out of fear because of the right-wing media causing a lot of fear around that term. And I'm just trying to distinguish my differences with that. Anyway, my opinion, which in my egotistical head of pure hubris, I dare say that my opinion is greater than the Supreme Court's opinions on quite a few things they've done to, these days, is that they cannot veer away from the Constitution and its amendments. The way that you interpret them is up for debate. Whether you want to textualize it or contextualize it or expand it. In the meantime, we'd better make some more amendments to make sure we explicitly write down that there are equal rights for women and men, for the LGBT community, for people of different races, that they all deserve rights equal under the law. Of course, let me just branch out here. I do remember there was a case, I think it was last year, right in the US-Mexico border. I think it was a scenario where there were children on the Mexico side of the border throwing like rocks and pebbles over across the border and probably hit a stationed officer there, and the stationed officer killed one of the children while he was on the US side, and of course when the child was on the Mexico side. And it went up to the Supreme Court because the mother of the murdered child tried to sue, saying that you couldn't do that. But the Supreme Court did not listen to the case because there was nowhere in the Constitution that specifically dealt with this type of scenario. branching it out, you can understand why the topic of immigration, why the talk of people search seeking asylum, why illegal immigration is such a difficult topic. There isn't, or the Constitution is for citizens of the United States of America. The people who are detained, people who are waiting for asylum, they are not citizens of the United States. So it becomes very difficult for people to find ways to grant rights to these people. So what I'm suggesting is maybe when we're writing amendments for the Constitution to somehow include that as well, where you're granting rights to people seeking asylum, granting rights to people who are in some way interacting with US citizens. And of course, there are international laws. We are under the UN, or we are in the UN, so there are international laws that we should follow. Question is, or the thing here is that it's not part of the Constitution, therefore, the Supreme Court, when ruling for or against anything immigration related, becomes very murky. So the safest bet is to add amendments to the Constitution that address these issues. All right. Well, thank you. No Baratheon the Science Man this week. Mainly because I couldn't find any worthwhile science articles. I've been binge watching Star Trek again. I finished The Next Generation last week, and I've started on Star Trek Voyager and Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I've watched a couple of the Star Trek movies, which I think is awesome. I'm not gonna watch the original series just because I am not patient enough with older TV series like the original Star Trek series. Very interesting episodes they had in TNG, The Next Generation. One if you know if you guys watch, I think I remember a while back I suggested an episode. Another episode, which I'm sure everyone suggests, is Measure of a Man. I find that to be pretty powerful, and I'd suggest it with all the other Trekkies. There's an episode called Drumhead in The Next Generation, which I think is pertinent to today's political landscape. And it would not just apply to the government itself, whether it's local, state, or federal. But I think the episode also applies to each of us as individuals treating other people with contempt or lack thereof. So definitely look those up, Measure of a Man and Drumhead. I would say Drumhead's probably the first thing you should watch because of all the back and forth attacks on each other. Measure of a Man definitely makes you think about the humanity in each every one of us, which is of course the overarching thing that we always need to recognize. So yeah, thank you folks for watching. Next week, again, it's going to be a supplemental episode of Court of Opinion. Instead of me railing against a religion, a specific religion or spirituality or lack thereof, I would like to provide some perspectives on the other side. And what I mean by other side is because I do identify as left-leaning, I would like to explore a little bit more of the right-leaning side in terms of how to have a fruitful discourse. Not a debate. Not absolutely a discussion because I'll be talking to myself, but I would like to describe some tools and techniques that I use when speaking with people who don't identify with the same political spectrum that I do. So hopefully you guys will listen to next week's episode, and at least consider some of the options that I would put forth for all of you. Again, thank you guys so much, and I wish that you all see hope through all things.